Welcome to Digital Leaders, the show in which I interview the digital leaders of today to educate you, the digital leaders of tomorrow. My name is Fabian Tausch and I'm the founder of Young Entrepreneurs Program, a program for the most talented young entrepreneurs from 17 to 23 years old. I'm 22 myself, so I'm pretty young. I did run a podcast in German for young entrepreneurs, basically, and that's how I ended up switching to an English podcast, doing an international program for young entrepreneurs, and always focusing on so many great people that are out there, that are very experienced, that can share so many insights, and are driving change today, and are in very great and leading positions, and it's just interesting to learn from people that are far ahead on the journey, and that's why I am doing what I'm doing here with the podcast. And today's guest is somebody, I said in the last episode in the end as well, he very surprised me, because for me, the company he's a digital officer for is definitely not a digital company and definitely not a media company, but he told me and showed me that this is the case. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. I met Jack during the Next Web 2018, and he's the son of one of the founders of Lush, the beauty and cosmetics company as I know it. And he told me, and we talked about why Lush is partly a media company and why it's so important for them to be a media company. So it was very insightful, very interesting, and I'm more than happy to share some insights with you and to have Jack Constantine, the chief digital officer of Lush, in the podcast. Here's the interview. Have fun. Welcome back to From TNW with the third interview that I'm recording here today. And today it's somebody I'm really interested in, because yesterday my picture and perspective of the company that we're talking about in a second was completely different. I just knew stores where I went in, could buy some soap or different stuff, walk out, and I have my product bought. And it's like, okay, it's fair, handmade, whatever. But now, this company is more a media company than I even realized, and it's highly into digital and e-commerce topics. And I'm sitting here with the chief digital officer of Lush, Jack Constantine. Okay, I mess it up. Today in the morning, I did it right with the Prince of the Netherlands, but now I mess it up. Sorry for that.
That's all right. If you got it right with the Prince of the Netherlands, you got the right priority.
No, I also think it's important here, but and we also talked about it before. So, Jack, now I have... Yeah, no, yeah, I have, don't have, should not mess it up with the pre and surname. The interesting thing is, first of all, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for your time.
No problem.
The interesting thing is, when did it happen that Lush transformed from a product company where I can buy beauty products to a media company? And how do you evolve on that?
So I joined Lush 15 years ago. My parents are the co-founders alongside a group of about five or six people who founded Lush in the UK about 23 years ago. And I joined 15 years ago, straight out of school, and was working. I was very interested in graphic design, and because of the type of skills that I was looking for, there weren't really courses out there at the time that were going to be really beneficial to my development. So digital tools like Adobe Photoshop or different tools that are going to benefit when you're trying to do design skills and learn that as an actual profession. So I went straight to work at Lush, and I started working on gift design, artworking, doing basic labels, bits and pieces. And then I moved through to doing different aspects of the business. So I went into like shop design and looked at a bit of that, and over my first probably 4 or 5 years, I worked through a lot of different design aspects that came to things like, we had a catalog called the Lush Times that we would design in-house and get printed and send out, and that was our way of communicating really as a brand. That plus our windows, our shop windows, were a way that we could design and say a message. So Lush has always been interested in using platforms to communicate storytelling. And then about 9 or 10 years ago, I was in a meeting where I was getting very frustrated because I was spending a lot of time working on designing Lush Times layouts. And I just walked into this meeting and just said, look, why are we not working on online marketing and working on these free tools that are out there to promote our brand? You know, we're spending all this money printing these things, but is that the most efficient use of money and time if we're trying to communicate what we're about? And they said, okay, you go away and start looking at online then. You go, stop doing the Lush Times design stuff and go and look at online. So I kind of moved over into the online part and started to kind of venture into the world of, like, at that point we were on MySpace. I was like, oh, we need to set up a MySpace page. Topshop's got 5,000 friends. We need to be doing this stuff. And obviously it's like really small scale kind of, I'm like 33 now. I was like 22, 23 then. And it was the beginnings of social media. We had a very popular Lush forum where we would talk to our customers on there, and they were very engaged, fanatical fans who, bit, you know, like Reddit can be like very, very kind of cliquey, and it wasn't very inviting, but it was a very engaged community. So I worked a lot on that, and started setting up social media channels, and it just became one base rule that I think pretty much set the precedent as to why we need to be thinking about, like, media, was that basically we don't advertise, so we don't pay for advertising, and the bulk of the cosmetics industry is based on that. So if you look at, like, major competitors like L'Oreal, they'll spend a third of their earnings on advertising, marketing budgets on advertising. And we don't do that. We don't spend our money on advertising. So if you want to get your messages out there, you need to be thinking outside the box of, oh, I just make an advert, pay someone, and they'll show it. So we've ended up over the last 10 years really evolving, kind of, and I suppose because of maybe like my age and my ability to take on that new approach, I've developed for Lush an approach to how we can build up a digital presence and build up our Lush, like, digital world alongside the shops, because it supports the shops so much. Like, when we get our social media right, when we get all of our digital content right, and we're communicating really well, we really help boost what the shops represent. So that's kind of like a bit of a backstory of where Lush has ended up on this journey, and kind of where we're going is that also over the last like 10, 12 years, we made a decision when Body Shop got bought by L'Oreal, we made a decision to be more proactively campaigning and make an effort to actually communicate to our audiences about the ethics we care about. So we worked on focusing on how we can communicate to our customers, our fans, what is going on with the different stories that we're interested in, whether that's like fighting animal testing or general ethical messages or under shared stories that we felt needed to be talked about. So we worked on using our shop windows as the first place to tell those stories. And then obviously as the online world opened up, I was kind of representing that, well, let's use these online tools to tell our stories more and more. And we've always been very focused on building things ourselves. Like we invent, manufacture and sell our own cosmetic products. So with that, we are used to product development, owning our own supply chain on that front. So we're kind of taking that approach to media. It's like, well, actually, why shouldn't we be thinking about how we as a business and a brand can use our business as a platform to share stories about topics we care about ethically, and messages, they're having fun down there, aren't they? And messages that we want to get out there, or we think are important to get out there, and use our business as a platform to help communicate, which, yeah, effectively has led us to becoming a media publisher, because we feel these stories need to be told. And we have the tools now online to tell the stories. Like, I mean, anyone can become a publisher, right? I mean, this is what you're doing. Like,
yeah, that's true.
And that's the approach we're taking, kind of a startup approach to publishing. But we have this massive business, this massive global platform we can use, rather than necessarily what most other corporate companies would be thinking about they've got this massive business they need to just look after and just make sure that big business is running. You know, they're not necessarily thinking, oh, I know, let's try and do our own media company.
That's true. And what you already mentioned with the forum in the early days that you started, you're building up a huge community. And I, as I'm not buying that often from Lush, to be honest, but now I got a bath bump, so maybe that's the first start. You were talking about community, and also in some other interviews that I read yesterday night as we met there the first time, you said it's very, very important. Why do you think community is so important for corporates, but also for like corporates at all? Going through the digitalization and building something new, like kind of a media startup in this case.
I mean, we're at TNW, and I've seen two or three presentations so far that are showing that the way that businesses and big corporates have been thinking about approaching marketing by leaning on the big data that you can use for these ad tech companies are offering, say, we can be really specific on who we tell the story to or your message to. And obviously you can measure all that, and you know, just seeing stats today of like, it's a £34 billion industry, the ad tech industry, and all these companies, big corporations, are putting their money over there. But the story at the moment is, it's not working. Like, actually, you need to have an approach to what story you're trying to tell, not just focus on pumping all the money over there and then saying, oh, we've got all the data, it's given us the information. You need to actually think about, are you engaging with your communities, and are you being relevant to the people that you're trying to connect with? If you're not relevant, it's not going to happen. I mean, that's how we all work online. If you think of a company as an individual, you know, as an individual, we join conversations online, and we have to have relevance with each other in the context of whatever's going on. A company has to be exactly the same. They have to have some relevance, some context. Why are they joining in? What's happening? And how do you understand that? By understanding your community and understanding how they want to hear things, or how you can interact with them. And that I think is something we've always had inherently in Lush, because we make, you know, we have a very fresh handmade approach to everything we do, because we make a product by hand. I think that mentality about being in the community, because it's all about the people, through the way that we look at our supply chain, we focus very much on community projects, grassroots projects in all over the world, often in countries in Africa or in places where, to be honest, a lot of our raw materials are coming from for the whole world anyway. But we focus on the projects that are really small, the community, the real community we can see. We have a great women's cooperative in Ghana that make shea butter for us, and we know them. You know, there's 200 women there now. It was 50 women when they started, and now it's 200. And that's a community that we're engaging with. For them, Lush has completely different context to what you're describing, right? Like, you know us for coming in a shop.
Yeah.
They only know Lush because we're giving them a livelihood, because we're buying their shea butter. Like, Lush as a brand, as a name, has a relevance in so many different communities. We've got strong connections in grassroots charities and organizations, because over the last 12 years, we've put £20 million into charitable organizations and campaigning groups in small amounts. We don't fund more than £20,000 to any one group. So that means if you do 20 million across 20,000, you get a lot of different groups. And what you do there is, rather than go, oh, we're a big company, let's give our money to a big charity, what you're doing is you're putting your money where your mouth is, and you're working with communities, and you're working with these groups, and you build the trust. And we do that everywhere. We do that in our supply chain, we do that in our charitable giving, we do that with our customers. And then that's where you garner the community, the sense of community. And we kind of have like a, almost like a world of niches, rather than thinking, oh, we want to look at this big mass market. What about all these little groups all over the world, whether that's, I mean, you look at the products we offer, vegan, non-animal testing, all these things, they start off small. They become, now veganism has become a much bigger story than it was 22 years ago when we were selling, you know, 70% of our products were vegan. So by engaging with those communities, they were small, but they've they've seen we've been there, mm-hmm. and they've grown with us. So we have a very strong connection with community, and it's been a critical part of our business growth, really. And I think one of our like secrets, best kept secrets to a degree, that's like allowed us to grow authentically and have a real relationship with the fans of Lush, from whatever reason they're a fan, whether that's because we support them because they're a charity, or whether that's because they buy the products.
As a lot of listeners will be number driven, even when they might not want to admit it, I told you before that I will ask this question, and it's, I think, a really important one to give perspective on what you're doing, because I think you're setting up yourself for the future and not just for now. But how do you drive revenue from content you create, or what are your expectations for the content?
The expectations for the content, the only thing we really measure is engagement. I mean, we talk about things like how far did it reach, but it's much more important to us that what we're creating is engaging with people, and that's positive, negative stimulation of conversation. So, you know, what are people actually thinking about what we're doing or what we're saying? And it's not really all about what we're saying either. Again, you know, when it comes to that, it's about making sure that we actually look at being a platform for others to be able to say their stories. So actually, we're more than happy to, once we're, you know, comfortable with different charities and organizations, for them to use us as a platform to get their messages out. And again, that stimulates conversation, debate, discussion, and ideally change. You know, like, I think one of the fundamental things with me is we need to be measuring things like on change. Like, we should be looking at a social change network, not like just a social network where we passively consume information. Oh, that's so sad, that's so bad, that's so great. But actually, what can we do about some of these situations, or what can we change? And we've always been like that in Lush, whether that's, can we create products that don't have packaging? Can we campaign for a topic that, you know, will change a law? Can we save more animals from being tested? Whatever it is, it's that moment of, is this going to result in an action? And I think that is going to be where it's where we look at ourselves from a measurement point of view. I know that is not numbers driven, and I know that's not what a lot of people who sit and look at business would want to hear. I mean, there was another good talk today that talked about quantitative data versus qualitative data, and the idea that effectively quantitative data is measurable. So it's much, our brains, like psychologically, we prefer that data. It's like, oh, I can understand and measure that. Qualitative data that is immeasurable is more valuable, but because we can't measure it, we really struggle. And a lot of the world I live in is the immeasurable. It's the, how engaging is this story? Well, you can only know through feeling. That isn't going to tell you 100% through data. You're going to get that from, does it feel like an engaging story, or is it coming across in a way, in a certain tone? So I think we're always going to end up in this slightly immeasurable world where you kind of have to go with your instincts, and you have to work a lot more intuitively. You can back that up with data. You can, obviously, how far did that reach? Like, how much engagement did it get? Measuring success, there's always that behind it. You're always going to be able to see that, but it shouldn't be the only way you measure quality of your content or quality of what you're delivering. You should be thinking about, I think that's where the gut instinct has to come in, of like, you kind of have to know what good looks like. If you don't have good standards, you're not going to understand. Yeah, you might reach a load of people, but it's not really relevant. Or, you know, and that's the problem. Say, for example, advertising. All advertising does is put eyes on your content. That doesn't mean your content's good.
That's true. What is your vision for Lush Digital?
We've basically set up a company within the Lush group that is Lush Digital. It's a global company providing digital services and tools for the Lush group and beyond, because if you look at major technology companies and especially say like the top 10 companies in the last 10 years, Facebook, Amazon, Google, Apple, the product range and the diversity of what they offer it varies, and often what they're building are tools that they use that they then sell. Amazon Web Services, the most profitable aspect of Amazon, actually was built because they needed their servers to be resilient, to be able to manage their e-commerce platform. They then sold that product because it, by making that resilient platform, why not sell it to other people? They can then have a resilient platform. They make money, Amazon grows, they'd even host competitors. It doesn't, for them, that's still valuable because the product has value, has, will gain them money, gain them revenue and profit. So if we're looking at what I've done with Lush, is I've looked at it technologically and digitally, media and technology, from a point of view of owning and building our own, a very DIY approach, where we can manage our ethical principles, we can manage the way that we want to tell stories, and we don't have to really lean on third parties that may let us down or might not be comfortable saying a certain message. So Lush Digital has been growing as a kind of startup inside a giant corporation to build these new tools for the future that we can create products from, that we can sell as products and services out. If you want, you know, we are building a till solution for our shops. It's a retail solution. It's based on tablets. We've built the code is open source. We're using Google Cloud to host it, which is all renewable energy. We're looking at sourcing our own tablet at the moment. We've been to Shenzhen and we're actually looking at making our own ethical tablet because we're not happy with any of the tablet market or the general tech industry from a point of view of looking after the planet that we're getting all of these resources from. A really good example of a company that is doing that is Fairphone, and we're working closely with them. And we're kind of taking a little bit more ownership as a company about how we approach digital, rather than thinking you can hire an agency and that agency is going to solve your problems, or, oh, it's okay, I'll get an enterprise system and then that will just fix everything. It won't anyway. It never does. So don't fall for that. You're much better off figuring out how to grow and nurture a seed of strategy around like what you can develop and what you can build and grow yourself. It's a longer term gain. It's not going to be short term. You're not going to get short term wins. And I've got plenty of failures under my belt on trying to get this thing moving. And even now, you know, I was only in a board meeting this week where I'm effectively, I have to put my hands up and say, yeah, you know, you've invested in me as a member of the board, and I haven't delivered the stuff I said I was going to deliver in the time frame I wanted to. I'm disappointed. I'm still asking for more money and I'm still asking for the commitment. And thankfully, because we're privately owned and we can gain that, I can gain that trust from the board, I can go away and continue the journey. Really, the investments, like, they're way smaller. I mean, we're spending 5 to 10 million on our digital investments when, you know, any major company who's trying to put in their technology, they're a retailer in the UK, you know, John Lewis spent £50 million on their system. Marks and Spencer's another one, you know, £40 million. They're all Kingfisher and B&Q, Kingfisher's like DIY things. They spent another £80 million on that. You know, they're not small numbers. They're spending a lot of money on this third party coming in and giving them services. I'm taking a different approach. I'm saying, let's just spend less money, but actually get, over the longer term, get better results out of that and be more in control. We've got our till solution that we built ourselves is going into our shops. We don't have to pay any license fees to anyone. It's on Linux, so it's open source. We're providing it back to charities and groups who can use it. We're going to start selling that solution to other companies who, if you want an ethical tech solution, we've got one. Why wouldn't we offer that? And media is similar. You know, we have the ability to help communicate stories for all these different charity groups, organizations, like-minded people, and ourselves. And we're kind of becoming a lifestyle brand because we have there is a lifestyle to Lush. There's an ethical principle to it. So it makes sense. It's not going to immediately become relevant. Like, you know, like you say, for you, you walk in the shop. That's going to take us years to change people's understanding of what Lush offers as a whole. But the communities that we really work with, they'll get it and they'll start to grow it with us. And it will provide big change for them. You know, when we get our social change platform up and running, our ability to have a Lush-owned media network online where they can communicate with each other and with their audiences, and we can as well, that's going to be a big game changer for us and for all those communities we work with and support. You know, I mean, and the pie is big enough for us to take a small slither, even in the cosmetics industry. You know, Lush is now a £1 billion company. The cosmetics industry is £330 billion market. You know, we represent 0.6% of the cosmetics industry. We are like tiny in the scheme of things. That's great. That means there's plenty of crumbs on the table. You know, we can just take them and build our business that way. We're not going to be an overnight success from a point of view of suddenly being up there with Amazon or with Google or with Facebook, but we only need to keep focusing on what we do, which is ethical, and we can start looking at selling digital products and selling media services and build our business through those as well as our cosmetic products.
You said that you're like a startup inside of the Lush Corporation, and for a startup, it's really, really important to focus on speed of implementation, and that's what you mentioned in a lot of interviews. How do you make sure that you can really have the speed of implementation inside a huge corporate?
Failing a lot. Failing lots and lots and lots and trying again. I think we've been trying, you know, taking an MVP approach, making the minimum viable products, trying to make sure that we push things out the door and then we learn from them. Like, say these tills, you know, we've it's a great user case for us because we can say, right, as digital, we'll build this till. Who's the users? Oh, they're our shops. Okay, great. Well, let's get some managers. Let's work with them. Let's try and figure out what they would love out of a till. They hate working with the tills. They're clunky. They're old. They're like, they're really confusing. They just want it simple. We only sell a line of up to 600 products max. We don't discount. So we don't, there's loads of tools we don't need, and we can just provide that for our staff. So by being like that startup agency in house, we're kind of consulting and working with the company and saying like, hey, retailers, what do you want? How do you want it? How do we build this up? And testing, real time testing, sprint, you know, demos, just making that, that kind of, keeping that agile lean approach to how we're working. And then working with the wider company that can't work the same way, but we can support them and we can kind of act in the way we function. We can drive that forward and start iterating on projects and say the tills, it's like 18-month projects really in total that we kind of started with, let's make our own, to we're rolling out, we've rolled out in the UK now. And again, the other thing we have to think about is with being a startup inside a corporation, we're like instant scale up. Like, we have to think about scalability like that. We've got 50 countries, we've got 900 shops. How are we going to make sure these products are actually going to work across the world? So that's quite an interesting challenge as well, because again, if you want to be speed of delivery, it makes you a little bit slower because you've got to think about scale before you're even at the start gate. You know, what languages can this support? What currencies can this support? Are we going to be able to build it? Because obviously the problem can be, if you build without thinking about those things at the beginning, you're then going to suffer later on down the line. So we do struggle with it, there's no doubt about it. It's a tug of war between the wider company and digital as to how to be kind of, yes, have that startup mentality and have that speed of delivery.
One thing of the many things you're doing that seems to work really well and is also implemented a bit longer is e-commerce, as the revenue is increasing rapidly. But what was the first step to implement an e-commerce store to a offline brand? Because I think it's a huge thing where many companies struggle that are really just offline to implement an online store and really increase the attention there.
Yeah. So with the digital side, I mean, the way our company split is in terms of revenue through product sales is 10% digital and 90% retail. And it fluctuates. Sometimes we might get to 12%. But what happens is the relationship really is about building the brand awareness, and we have a very brand-led commerce approach. So we're constantly focused on how, as a brand, we're going to communicate all our stories, what's so unique about our products. We don't sell our products on Amazon. You can't go in online and look at our products and compare them on different sites. You can only go to a Lush site to find out what products we're selling. The amount of traffic we get I mean, we know that 80% of the traffic is going to the shops. We like they're looking at the products and they're going to the shop and they're saying, "I want to buy this." So we're building the brand through the products online, while still making revenue out of the e-commerce side. So it's always been very brand led. I mean, we had a website in 1995. It was like at the beginning of the internet. We were there with like this HTML page, like literal web pages, you know, all linked up with a checkout flow and all this stuff. And so we've always had an online presence since the beginning, and always had that kind of mail order e-commerce, but it's developed and evolved over time, where as digital has. So it's always been seen. I mean, interestingly, it's the same as the way we focus on our shops. Like, we have a very unique shop design layout. We have a very unique kind of tone and style to them. And that's similar to the way we have our online presence. Like, our website is unique, and we focus on how we're going to tell stories about the products, what we're going to be doing about this stuff to really help people understand what Lush is about. So it's great because it leads us to being a media company again, because it's all about communicating and storytelling to really help sell your products.
What I think is also a good point that Olivia, your PR responsible person, yep, I would say like that, told us yesterday, is like you're transforming or using your your slogan, you're transforming it or using it from just handmade products also in the digital world. So yep, that's what you're always referring to, like with ethical and other values that you're focusing on. But so many companies are not just sticking to the values, that are they are adding or focusing on a thousand different things. What are the challenges that you have, because you say, okay, we will take the values and go into a completely new branch, niche, however you call it?
I mean, there's always going to be challenges. The main thing we focus on is that we feel and believe that we provide an ethical alternative. So we don't look at competitors directly and go, oh, let's compete, they're selling this, we'll sell that. We just look at it and say, can we provide an ethical alternative to what's out there? And that doesn't mean what's out there. Some of those alternatives might be, it didn't exist before, let's invent new products. So we've always had a product development route. And like this real strong core aspect of like where Lush's heritage comes from, around kind of being in the lab and making something small scale and then getting it out the door and getting out en masse. So there's always been a very R&D product development base to our business, and we believe a lot in the products, and we understand how to make products and then feel confident enough to put them out there and sell them, which is literally like, you know, we worked, so my parents are cosmetic scientists and they've worked in cosmetics for years, and they were trained by Stan Crystal, who was who basically did a lot of work on Nivea in the very beginning, created the core products, and he taught them a lot about basically when you create a product, how to iterate a product and get it out the door. So at one point my parents were creating these new soaps and they were sweating in the lab. They kept sweating, they had sweat beads all over them. They're like, we can't sell these soaps, people are gonna not want to buy this soap. And Stan just said, don't worry, put it out the door. And they were panicking about it, and they did it, put the soaps on the shop floor, they never sweated again. Sometimes you have to just draw the line and go, we just got to go out there and do this. We've made this product, we've got to push it out the door and see how it goes. And that, I think, because of that mentality, it's given us a confidence to look in loads of different areas and think, yeah, let's just make this, you know, we've got something here, let's make it, put it out the door, let's see what happens. It doesn't matter if it's tiny, if it doesn't grow, it doesn't grow, maybe we shut it down after a while. If it grows, great, look, we've got a new area. So I think it's much more about just getting on and getting out there and doing it, more so than ending up in reams of market research and, oh, should we, shouldn't we, and, oh, you know, have we got it all right? This is the community thing. You're only really going to know once you put something out there how successful it's going to be. We just launched a whole hashtag Lush Labs approach to the way we launch products online, which is like, we're literally making stuff, and as soon as we know that it's tested, we're putting it out to our customers and we're just saying, this is fresh from the lab, tell us what you think. Like, do you want us to change it? Do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? Like, until you start getting real real feedback, you can never, it's never going to be right. And I think, again, that approach is the long term. That means you might put it out first, it doesn't work, take it back, try something else, do this, or something else goes out the door, bestseller. I mean, I work in the labs making products as well as doing digital. So I think that's part of where my mentality comes from. You know, I work on and invent bath bombs, like intergalactic bath bombs, like our number one bestseller. And I worked on that 4 years ago. Would I have known it was going to be a number one bestseller? No chance. I worked on 10 bath bombs. We put 10 bath bombs out there. That one is the number one bestseller out of those 10. None of us could have predicted it. It's amazing. That's so exciting. Out of those 10, like 3 or 4 we've discontinued. Like, you're never going to predict what a bestseller is or what's going to really make you a success story. You've just got to be confident enough to go out there with something you've got and not keep it behind closed doors, and or not ever feel confident enough to give something a try. That's basically, I think, the core approach as to why we keep entering, thinking about these different niches or different areas. As well as things like, if we don't do it, if we don't get up as a company and start talking about stories that help change, who will? Is the other question. And that's why, that's what drives us as well. If we don't start talking about this situation, we've got palm oil is taking, you know, palm oil plantations are taking over the Indonesian rainforest and it's getting destroyed. And we need to stop using palm oil in our products, and we need to tell everyone stop buying palm oil. If we don't do it, who's going to do that? So it drives us even more to think that we're all on one planet. If we don't all start thinking about these things, same with tech for good, if we don't start thinking about the fact that we've got 5 billion devices, they're all made of the planet. All these devices are made from the earth. We're mining the hell out of it. If we don't start thinking, hang on, what are we going to do about this? Then who is? And that's often where we find ourselves leading, like unintentionally leading, like, oh, no one else is thinking about this, but we're going to keep driving it. And that, I think, stimulates it as well.
One thing that you predicted and that will highly affect Lush as well is that retail commerce will totally change. What are your opinions on the change of retail, maybe to e-commerce or whatever? So what are the predictions that you have in mind?
I think, obviously, like, the high street has transformed dramatically because of e-commerce. That's one phase. And then commerce as a sense of trading, the ability to purchase. What's so exciting at the moment is obviously everyone, consumers, customers, we're able to get products sent to our house or sent like right here, right now. But you know, I could probably order a Deliveroo and get it right here, right now in 20 minutes. So you can suddenly get different products and services just wherever you are and they'll appear. And so having that kind of next step going on around a customer being able to really buy anything anywhere at any time, we focus a lot on looking at our global business, understanding where to invest in our infrastructure and where to invest in our technologies to say, like, okay, we want to focus on a global customer, a global citizen who they want to be able to shop in any language because they're a Japanese speaking person in the UK on a certain day. Why should they not be able to read it in their language and get the information they need and buy a product in pounds because they're in the UK? Like, that's like a very, what we're kind of calling like a unified commerce approach. Like, you've got to really build your own platform to do that because there's not many platforms out there. We're working with partners like Adyen, who are great on the payment provider stuff and the global elements, but there's not many partners out there who are really that global. And so for us, like, I think the future is going to be interesting and varied. So the first thing I would say with Lush is that on the high street, customer experience is number one. Like, there'll always be staff. We will always have people in our shops, staff in our shops, talking to customers. I don't think that's going to be the same everywhere on the high street. I think it's going to get more and more automated, more and more robot orientated, and less human. That's not actually very healthy in a lot of ways for us, right? I mean, we're talking right now, it's interaction, it's healthy, it's stimulating, it. You need human interaction. And I think it's a massively unique aspect of what Lush has already on the high street. That's why we're standing out. We're basically retaining that. We're like, no, we're not gonna replace our tills with self-service checkouts and not have people there. Like, we're not gonna do Amazon's thing, you just walk in and buy stuff and walk out and never speak to anyone. Like, we're going to encourage that human interaction. But that doesn't stop the fact that there's a plethora of amazing opportunities coming up with, say, like AI. Yeah, we can use machine learning to create much better ways of providing the right types of products to our customers online, and even helping them if they want to go on their phone and look through in a shop. It's not a problem to do that. We won't ever take away the people, the human interaction, and the importance of having our staff in our shops. But we will add new tools and new services. We can have built-in machine learning, image recognition, so that we can have products without packaging, and you can scan it with your phone and it will tell you the ingredients. Great. We don't want packaging. So the more we can get rid of that, the more we can reduce the amount of materials we're creating and using, the better. And that's, you know, there's your product, you use that product, there's your information, it's in a device, done. I think there's going to be a lot more automation out there that's going to be beneficial to creating a better experience, and it's all going to be experience led. Like, if you don't offer a good experience on the high street, you know, that's pretty much, I think, retail in the traditional sense of what it means, like commerce, would just become automated. But showcasing experiential journeys will always be very real and literal, and like being on location, being in that place. You know, we, no matter what I do about making products amazing online, it will never be the same as going to a Lush shop, picking up a bath bomb and smelling it and chucking it in some water. Like, that's never gonna, I mean, I say never gonna happen online, maybe it will, but I can't see it happening. And I don't know whether we necessarily want that. Like, you want tangible experiences, and there'll be this dual world between the digital world that's out there and the physical world, and this kind of marriage between them. And there'll be, we'll kind of get it much better. We'll learn as we go and evolve it to a really good place where actually those very human experiences will become even more human, whilst this digital world can sit alongside it and actually elevate it. I think we're at a bit of a naive state. You know, we're stuck on devices, looking at our phones. You know, once augmented reality gets much stronger, glasses, you know, you could be looking, we could be talking at this table and I can be getting information, showing things around what's going on, and it will support what's happening. It won't take away from what's happening. I won't be looking at a screen down here. So I think everyone's got very caught up on this whole idea, you know, tech Sabbath, like put your devices away for a day or try not to get on social media and all this stuff. It's much more to do with the tools than it is the actual virtual digital reality. I think the digital reality thing is a positive move for the whole global society. I mean, we forget these smartphones, they are like miracles in countries like India and China, in countries all over Africa. They've never, you know, we've got villages in China that literally never had a device, and then all of a sudden they've got mobile phones, and they're seeing the whole world in it, as far as China's firewall will let them, unless they get their VPN sorted out. And eventually that will change. The VPNs will kick in, China will get integrated. So all of a sudden we've got a global community. Like, that is insane. Like, it's crazy how we don't see it as much. We're in the Western culture. You know, for us, it's another device, another distraction. But for them, it's life-changing. Like, you've given this person the ability. You know, when we're buying our ingredients from farmers in Africa, they have to rely on the sales rep who comes around and says, yeah, I'll buy your corn off you, whatever it is they're buying, and they'll tell them the going rate for the ingredient they're selling, and they just have to rely on the fact that they're telling them the truth, which they're often not, because they're going to try and undercut what the price is, and they've got no way of checking what the actual price of what they're selling is, so they kind of have to go with it. But now they can, now someone can literally get their phone out and go, no, I'm not selling it to you for that, I'm selling it for the market rate. Like, so you're changing, like genuinely changing lives around the world with this kind of positive technology. And yeah, there is the opportunity for tech for good to actually be for good, like technology to be built for good purposes, for it to become something socially relevant and really driving true change. And that, I think, beyond retail, like the social change element, again, unless people get behind it, it won't happen. But with people behind it, it really will. Same with Elon Musk and his vision for Tesla. He's driving that, you know, and he's got people with him. And if he wasn't driving that, we wouldn't be looking at what he's trying to create with solar power, with electric cars, with all these opportunities that he's, you know, bringing. That's the same here, really. We've got an opportunity to drive a new social change through what technology has offered us, like how it can really impact what we do. And if every company doesn't start thinking like a tech company, they're not going to be here in a few years. Every company needs to start thinking that they need to understand technology. They need to have it built into what they're doing. Otherwise, I can't see how you're going to be relevant.
Really, really interesting to chat with you about digitalization and also what's happening inside of Lush, what some people might not have noticed yet. So I hope we could open some eyes. Really, really thankful for your time. I really appreciated it and I wish you the best. Maybe we will hear an update a few months or years later in the podcast. So thank you very much, Jack.
Thank you very much for having me.
And enjoy the TNW and good luck with your talk tomorrow.
Thanks a lot.
Wasn't that interesting? It was so different from what I thought about Lush. By just walking by the stores, smelling beauty products, and just knowing that they are very, very natural and looking for the environment and everything else, but the tech for good stuff, I really liked. It was new to me, so hopefully it was new to you as well. And new to us. It's definitely a topic that I'm talking about with the next person as well that will join in the next interview. He is responsible for artificial intelligence at PwC in the UK, PricewaterhouseCooper. And we are talking about the opportunities that AI will bring and why or what's the current state of it. And yeah, it's just insightful from somebody who's working the whole day with AI and not just headline reading. I am headline reading as I am doing it all day long. So here is a short snippet from the interview with Rob McCargo, recorded as well at the Next Web, but at the 2019 edition. So feel free to stay a bit longer than you hear my voice, because then Rob McCargo will give you some short introduction and insights into artificial intelligence, and then you will hear him fully in the next interview. Thank you very much. My name is Fabian Tausch. Feel free to connect with me. You find all the links below. Hear you, talk to you in the next episode. Here is Rob McCargo. Speaking of one of the hottest topics, artificial intelligence, what is your take on the state of AI at the moment? Where are we? Where can we go? What's happening? What is the current state? Because I think a lot of people don't have that much insight into the topic as they might want to, or the press is just covering headlines and just speaking about a bit of it. But I think there's way more that you might have more insight in, and I think your opinion is very interesting on this case.
Okay, point. I mean, just a brief history lesson. It's not a new technology. It's been around for decades, since the 1950s, and there's been several AI winters along that time where the raw ingredients and the environmental conditions weren't sufficiently optimized to scale the technology. But now, in a world with significant amounts of data, with vastly superior compute power and some innovation in the technology itself, this is starting to provide genuine utility in our lives. It's already here as consumers and our smartphones and recommendation algorithms. But we are now starting to see this being applied to really hard business problems, whether it's in financial services, in healthcare, retail, energy. All the industry sectors are starting to feel the benefits of this. In terms of the state of it, however, we've got a few obstacles to overcome to really start seeing the ability to scale this even further. We conduct a CEO survey that we publish at Davos at the World Economic Forum every January, and we've just published our 22nd consecutive CEO survey in January just gone. And in this one, we went quite deep into the topic of AI. And the interesting findings in this for me were suggesting that a vast majority of CEOs were saying that AI will have a significant impact on their business in the next 5 years. In fact, as high as 85% of them were saying that would be the case. But single figures, a very, very small minority, were saying that AI has been adopted broadly across the entire breadth of their business at the moment. And why is that? There's a number of reasons that we think this is the case. So, I mean, first of all, It starts with data. Have you got the right access, quality, and scale and condition of data to make good on the promise of the technology? A critical issue at the moment, and one for your listeners I think will be interesting at the moment, is talent. It's no longer the case that the investment in this is prohibitive. Most of this technology is available in open source now, but you need fantastic talent in data science and engineering and beyond to help configure and deploy this stuff. So therefore, your ability to attract talent in an incredibly competitive landscape is crucial now. Just to give you some background around the demand here, the Royal Society in the UK, a very prestigious think tank, have just published a report that suggests that in the past 5 years, demand for data scientists has increased by 231% in that time frame. So you can see that organizations really have to be able to put their stall out to demonstrate why this talent should join them. And then on top of that, it's working out where to start. You could potentially have hundreds, if not thousands, of potential problems to solve with the technology across all of your back office or front office or wherever. So you can soon start wasting time and money on getting stuck in a cul-de-sac. So working out where to start is critical. So when you start looking at the broader choice you have from there, you also have a difficulty understanding who you partner with. There was a really eye-catching report that came out about early 2019 from a venture capital company that suggested that of the several thousand companies that were claiming they were AI companies in Europe, startups, once they'd undertaken their diligence and understood about the background technology of these companies, in 40% of these AI companies, they could find no evidence of any AI. So you can imagine if you're a corporate executive, you're working out who to partner with, you have hundreds of problems, you have thousands of vendors you can go with, that match is really critical. And then we also have a whole array of potential concerns at C-suite. We have, of course, a climate in which trust in big business is at a low point. So I think corporate executives are increasingly concerned that the impact of AI, if not harnessed the right way, can lead to a further erosion in trust. We have a whole set of concerns about the lack of global governance and guidelines and guardrails around how to do this well. We have this whole new set of ethical considerations about the secondary and tertiary effects of this technology, the unintended consequences. Could this cause regulatory damage for organizations? Could it cause reputational harm? Could it lead to commercial loss? And we also have this fundamental issue with regards to AI. As we start moving this technology from applications of very little consequence on our lives, as we said before, movie recommendation algorithms, getting you to a meeting on time, it's not the end of the world if it doesn't work out well, but if it's denying you mortgage or credit in financial services, if it's diagnosing certain types of cancer in healthcare, if it's deciding upon whether you're granted bail in a criminal justice use case, you want to be damn sure you understand that the decision has been made in a fair, impartial, unbiased, and transparent way. And with regards to the more powerful forms of AI, we have a particular issue around the black box problem. We refer to it as interpretability or explainability. So until we have the ability to overcome some of these challenges, there is a huge demand for professional humans in the loop that can inspect, audit, accredit, and challenge the decisions that machines make before we unleash the full power of this and fully automate the technology.